Welcome to The Final Word, a Bible teaching ministry with pastor, teacher, and author Jim Andrews. The Final Word is grounded on the invincible conviction that what the Bible teaches, God teaches, and that is the last word. On this program, truth still matters. The Bible is in, Babel is out. The Final Word is funded by listeners like you. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about the program, please go to our website at thefinalwordradio.com. There you'll find archives so you can listen to any program you may have missed. Visit us on Facebook at The Final Word Radio and write us a note. We love hearing from our listeners. We'll provide other contact information at the end of the program, so have your pen ready. And now, Jim Andrews continues his study of God's Word.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us again on The Final Word. Before I launch today's exposition, I want to take about 3.5 minutes to make our listening audience aware, in case any of you are not, of not only the books that I have authored, but some articles that I have written that you might be interested in, and tell you how to access them. In my broadcast, some of you have noticed that you hear very little about financial support, and that's deliberate. We really trust God here on that score and firmly believe that God pays for what He orders. The same policy is true in my local church ministry. Other than the teaching we offer on these broadcasts, over the years I have done a good deal of writing, as time allows, to prepare resources that I think should be helpful to my congregation and also helpful to you, our listeners. But on this program, I don't say a lot about those resources, much as I don't say a lot about finances, and I guess that omission in terms of resources kind of defeats the purpose. So grab a pen and paper and get prepared to write down a website. If you will go to jimandrewsbooks.com, that's one word, jimandrewsbooks.com, you will find there information describing the 5 books I have authored, one of them co-authored with my daughter. In fact, that book, The Finality of Jesus Christ, is not a long book, but it's a very important book. And if anybody will let the Scriptures answer their questions about whether there are many ways to God, this will be decisive. Another very important book I've written is Polishing God's Monuments, Pillars of Hope for Punishing Times. I've written a book on marriage. Should help a lot of people if both are serious about walking with God in their marriage. Marriage Without Remorse, Rules for the Road. Another book, A Life Worth Dying For, The Radical Meaning of Christian Excellence. Personally, I love that book. It's my heartbeat. And finally, What About the Pastoral Ministry would be good for elders and leaders, too. Dispatches from the Front Lines, Reflections on the Glory and Grind of Pastoral Ministry. On top of that, on the same website, you'll see a tab that says Articles. If you will open that with your cursor, you will discover there are some articles that I've produced over the years that you may find interesting and helpful. For example, the most recent article is my take on the demise of the culture wars and where I think we ought to go from here. Another article that appeared several years ago in a journal for biblical manhood and womanhood is entitled Boundaries Without Bonds. Another is a rebuttal of a tract that appeared several years back. The author attempted cleverly, but as I will show unsuccessfully, to persuade us that the Scriptures do not condemn homosexual practice after all. That has all been a misunderstanding. Well, there will be others, but I mentioned those three. I'm not a regular blogger, but when sometimes things pop up on my radar that I feel I would like to address in a thoughtful way, I will sometimes produce a longer article like some of these. So I'm just happy to share them with you for whatever benefit they may have. Now, back to our current study. We continue our exposition of the book of Hebrews. We're in chapter 13, drawing closer and closer to the end of this study. The writer is admonishing these Hebrew Christians to step up their game, walking in holiness. Let the love of the brethren continue, not talking about a feeling, talking about a behavior. More specifically, he mentions, do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers. In the Roman world, especially, things were not like they are in our modern world. You didn't have all the hotels and the motels and the accommodations that we have in our world. Christians were moving back and forth, and sometimes for them, or for anybody, but especially for them, things could get a little dicey. So open your hearts and open your homes, for by it some have entertained angels without knowing it. You wouldn't want to insult a heavenly guest who may appear in human form. So do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers. We're God's people, and be hospitable to God's people who may be out there in the cold, in need, needing warmth, whatever. For by this some have entertained angels without knowing it, like Abraham and Lot, to mention two examples. Then he says in verse 3, in the same vein, remember the prisoners, as though in prison with them. Identify with them, empathize with them. And remember those who are ill-treated, since you yourselves are also in the body. One class of individuals calls for special attentiveness on the part of the church. Here in verse 3, he's talking about those who are imprisoned for Christ's sake. The phrase "for Christ's sake" is implied in the definite article. By the definite article, I mean the thee. He doesn't say generically, remember prisoners, as though he's talking about anybody in prison. He says, remember the prisoners. And what he goes on to say, as though in prison with them, those who are ill-treated, since you yourselves are in the body. So this is a body thing, and many believers were ill-treated. Remember the Apostle Paul, before he was ever converted, was going around hauling in Jewish Christians from as far away, at least he intended to, as Damascus, put them in prison. They killed Stephen. They were being abused. Though the persecution of the church had not yet reached such a crescendo in their case that their blood was actually being shed, we saw that in chapter 12, verse 4, it doesn't mean that it hadn't happened before. It happened in Jerusalem and Judea. James, of course, was murdered. The Apostle Paul had a hand in murdering Stephen, and believers were scattered everywhere and persecuted. But many of their number elsewhere had been, and were continuing to be victims of rough and oppressive treatment at the hands of authorities. He mentions some of the rough treatment that these to whom he is writing had been exposed to back in chapter 10, verses 32 through 34. And their abuse included imprisonment and the dispossession of their property. Brotherly love should start with empathy, remembering these people by putting themselves in their position as though in prison with them, as he puts it, and responding to their needs accordingly. What if that were me? How would I feel? What do I think I would need? Well, you do to them as you would have someone do to you. Were you in the same positions? And since you yourselves are still in this physical body, the writer is telling them you should have no trouble envisioning what being locked up in chains in a cold, dank, stark, food-spare Roman dungeon would do to a person. So remember your brethren when they're mistreated. What would you most want and what would you most need if you were in their place? Do the same for them. Now he comes to a moral issue. Verse 4. Let marriage be held in honor among all. And let the marriage bed be undefiled. If we need an incentive, here it is. For fornicators and adulterers, God will judge. A few years ago, I was messing around with some Christmas lights around dusk. I happened to see a neighbor, who is a Christian lady, all bundled up out in the foggy cold, sweeping up some leaves. I'd not seen her in a while. In fact, I rarely see any of my neighbors since I seldom get home before dark, particularly in the fall and winter months. So I cheerfully greeted her, and I just asked her how things were going as I walked slowly in her direction. She looked at me a little funny with a quizzical look, as if she wondered if there was something more to my question than just conventional courtesy. And then she looked at me and she said, "Have you heard what happened?" she inquired a bit timidly. "No," I responded. "I haven't heard anything. What are you talking about?" "Oh," she replied, "I thought you knew about it, and that may have been why you hadn't said anything." "No," I said, "I don't know anything about anything." "Well," she went on sadly, referring to her presumably believing husband, "she said he left me last February, or it was March, I don't quite remember. He's down in Arizona now with his new girlfriend." "Oh," I said as I called her name and hugged her, "I am so sorry. I had no idea. It just kills me that you've been going through this all this time and we haven't been there for you. That's awful. We had no clue." Actually, that was not quite accurate, for the fact is, for some time, Aussie and I had been noting that something seemed different in their family habits, but nothing that invited us to be bold enough to ask so pointedly. Well, she asked for prayer and then went on to relate that this was not the first time her presumably believing husband had been unfaithful to a spouse, she had learned. She had learned the same thing happened in a previous marriage. Turns out this fellow was an adrenaline junkie. He always needed some source of excitement in his life. Maybe it was a new toy, in this case just a new woman. And she mentioned that he was scared to death of getting old, and he needed to prove to himself that he still had enough left to attract a younger flame. That's pitiful. So sad, but so typical of what's going on out there, unfortunately, even in the pews. If there has ever been a period in American history when the institution of marriage was so imperiled and held in such low regard, it has escaped my notice. Certainly not in my lifetime. What's going on in the culture with respect to marriages is alarming enough. Rampant promiscuity before marriage, people living together outside of wedlock and thinking nothing about it, serial infidelity in marriage, and now so-called civil unions and this contradiction in terms, same-sex marriages. And if that is bad, what is more appalling is that the sins and the excesses of the culture always spill over into the churches to such an extent that, maritally speaking, the state of domestic affairs, no pun intended, seems almost as bad inside the church as outside. Today, one of the enemy's strategic targets seems to be the family, the fundamental social unit of the culture, as well as of the churches. One of the marks of a disciple of Jesus Christ, my friends, is domestic fidelity. It's one thing to say we are Christians, it's another thing to be one. There is no way one can be rightly aligned with Christ and be wrongly related to one's spouse, and certainly no way one can be walking with God and having an affair formally or functionally with someone other than one's spouse. So our writer implores these Hebrew Christians to let marriage be held in honor among all. Let the marriage bed be undefiled. Now let's look closely at the text. What does it mean to hold marriage in honor? The Greek adjective temios carries the connotations of something precious, of something of great worth or value, something held in high regard. Thus, to hold marriage in honor means to treat your marriage as something precious, treat it as an institution of consummate value, as an honorable estate to be held in the utmost regard, not just in principle, but in practice. Now, such an admonition obviously had a historical or a cultural context that rendered the appeal situationally germane. It did not come out of the blue, in other words. This appeal found its cause in local conditions familiar both to the author and to his readers. In that era, the state of marriage was not treated as something sacred by the culture in general. The Greco-Roman culture. And these Hebrew Christians were scattered all over the Hellenistic world. In fact, from certain things the Apostle Paul taught in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, if taken out of context, one might easily come away deprecating marriage as, at best, an institution of sexual convenience and one that presented an obstacle to serving God. Combine biblical passages that might be misunderstood by some with the general low views of marriage in that day, plus the philosophical influence of Eastern dualism that posited a polarity between the spirit and the body. That meant they held that only the spirit was pure and everything of a material or bodily nature, including its functions, were intrinsically evil. But you put all that together in the cultural context, all that stuff was swimming around together in the same cultural pond. Well, one can easily see how these sources of influence might have combined to persuade Christians then, as today, to think poorly of marriage in principle and cause them to treat their own marriages with less than great respect. For us Christians, let marriage be held in honor among all. In our culture, for different reasons, we face, as I mentioned, the same problem. With so many dysfunctional people creating dysfunctional marriages, with so much heart-rending divorce, and with so many kids with bad memories getting emotionally twisted out of shape by these marital train wrecks, with serial marriages on the increase, and cohabitation out of wedlock almost a rite of passage for many, I think it should be no surprise to any of us that marriage has lost its biblical cachet as a sacred institution. To many, I think it's safe to say that marriage poses more headaches than just shacking up and offers no obvious advantages, so compelling as to beg for people to get married. That's kind of the world we live in. But that's not the biblical perspective. The biblical perspective is totally at odds with all those ideas. Ultimately, we're dealing with God, and with God, marriage is inviolable. It's not some kind of human social contract. Marriage is a divinely established institution. We see it back in Genesis, and it's for the good of mankind. And it's to be considered sacred, holy, because, A, God established it, and because God not only established it, he made it inviolable. It's to be valued not only because it's sacred, but because it is an expression of the wisdom of God for the well-being of man as a social being. So, to hold marriage in honor is to esteem it rightly in principle, to see it as a sacred institution devised by God himself for the social welfare of mankind, and in practice to treat our own marriages as a precious gift of God, to be protected and preserved for our common good and his glory. Now that raises a practical question. How does one go about honoring one's marriage? Well, let me give you a list. First of all, refuse to be a party to running down the institution, for that's an insult to God. It's a reflection on his wisdom. Marriage is not hard. We are hard. Never enter into a marriage lightly and urge others to do so as a matter of economic convenience or emotional escape, for that's just wasting a diamond to patch a hole. Thirdly, how do we honor our marriages? Never allow yourself any exit clause other than God's, and God offers one, and that's infidelity. Four, consider your commitment to your vows inviolable, and also consider your right to marital happiness a gigantic myth. Remember, our Christian life's all about holiness. Project one is not happiness. Happiness runs right through the middle of holiness. Fifth, resolve to be a servant to your spouse. How do you go about honoring your marriage? Resolve to be a servant to your spouse. Treat them with respect and put their interest and needs ahead of your own. That's not just in marriage. That's in all social relationships we are taught. How do we honor our marriage? Sixth, respect the position when it's hard to respect the person. Let me elaborate on that. Do not compliment a fool by making one of yourself. He may be a slob, for example. Don't let the slob turn you into a shrew. Your partner may have no self-respect. Don't let them rob you of yours. Your partner may be dumb, but don't let them make you stupid. Your partner may be a bumpkin, but you don't have to let them turn you into a pumpkin. In short, one can honor marriage by refusing to allow its infirmities and imperfections to ruin us and rob us of our self-respect. But allow those things to refine our own rough edges, and like the heat and pressure that forms diamonds, shape and enrich us through sufferings. One of our ladies told me just last week, she's a wonderful woman, very stable woman, but she has a rough marriage. She came to know Christ after the fact, and her family's not a believing family. I said to her, so-and-so, how are things going? I love the answer. Oh, Pastor, nothing is changing, but I'm changing. Ah, that's it. Sometimes those things don't change, but we can be changing by the grace of God. Well, that's how you can honor your marriage. What does it mean to keep the marriage bed undefiled? It's another way of admonishing us to maintain strict sexual fidelity to our spouses. The author here inserts a huge incentive for domestic faithfulness. There's a sobering warning for tempted disciples, and all of us certainly can be tempted in these directions. He warns that fornicators and adulterers God will judge. Now, we understand why he says adulterers God will judge in this context where he's telling us to keep the marriage bed undefiled. But fornication is a term that describes with a broad brush sexual transgressions on the part of the unmarried. So that invites the question, why does he bring up fornication in this context? Well, for a couple reasons. Fornication is a major expression of disrespect for the institution of marriage. And how's that? Well, when an unmarried person goes to bed with someone, they are brazen enough to engage in a sacred act approved by God only within the holy confines of marriage. Transgressing that sacred boundary debases a human intimacy expressive of the mystical union of a man and a woman, all for the momentary gratification of one's carnal pleasure. Now, with the cultural arbiters of our social mores, crossing that line may no longer be deemed serious at all. But it is. The media talking head will say all importantly, I don't care what people do in the privacy of their own bedroom, blah, blah, blah. But a public official lying to the electorate, now that's a capital offense. Well, friends, I want to tell you something. Those who say such things are, first of all, usually people have something to hide and they're just trying to excuse their own moral excesses. Secondly, their opinions are quite irrelevant, because they don't determine the laws and the judgments of Almighty God. Well, friends, our time has expired. We'll come back to this theme in our next study. God bless you and have a wonderful day.
The Final Word is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about this program, please visit our website at thefinalwordradio.com. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. Our email address is info@thefinalwordradio.com. And our phone number is 503-699-9840. If this program is ministered to you, tell a friend about it. We do solicit your prayers for God's hand upon this outreach.